you, Peter. Good evening, everyone. You awake and ready? I've just been reading the Ramayana that song is referring to there. And in the story, Hanuman is an ordinary type of monkey until he's reminded of who he really is. And then he becomes stupendously strong. He can make himself as large as a mountain or as small as a little bird and everything in between. And then he puts his mind on Ram, which to him is God, and then he becomes all-powerful. So it's a wonderful story. Reading from the Vision magazine, from Ananda Ashram. And in there they have excerpts from Peace Pilgrim. And Peace Pilgrim, as I've had the pleasure and the great gratitude to meet with some very great saints, and she was one of the greatest. She was here in America. When I met her, I was going to university. She happened to be there. I've never heard of her before that, and she was speaking to a group of students there about peace. And she described her own story. She's a woman, I would guess, at the time she was probably in her early or mid-50s. She had been deeply introspective and had lived a life in the world, but was more and more drawn toward the idea of peace. She was walking out in the woods one day on a long walk, and suddenly the inspiration came on her that she should go out on a kind of a pilgrimage for peace, and she would walk 25,000 miles for peace. She dressed in some canvas white shoes. She had cotton pants on, a sweatshirt with two pockets in them, and it said 25,000 miles for peace. And she would walk until she was given rest, and she would fast until given food. And she took off on her journey. And if people were interested, they see her sign, and they would stop and have her talk, ask her about what this was about, and then she would talk to them. And she talked about there first had to be inner peace, and then we would have world peace. She walked her 25,000 miles, if you can imagine, just off, walking up and down the highways and byways of America. She would come to a place sometimes, she said, where there's just a piece of concrete, and she would tell her body, "You go to sleep there." You know, with all of our comfortable beds and everything that we have, and she would lay down and she'd go to sleep right there. And she said that she never felt threatened by anybody. She only met good people along the way. She fulfilled her 25,000 miles for peace, and she kept on going. And then she did 50,000. And then she would accept rides. So Michael McCurley and I, who were going to school there at the time, we listened to her give her talk. We gave her a ride from Seattle. We wanted her to come and meet Mother Hamilton, but she had an appointment in Bellingham at a radio station where she was going to be interviewed there. So we took her from Seattle up to Bellingham, about an hour and a half ride, and it was a wonderful time spent with her as she continued to tell us stories about her life on the road. And she lived simply like that. And she continued to live like that until, this was 1979 or so when I met her, and I believe it was in the late 1980s that she was in a head-on car accident, and she was killed instantly. So she died with her tennis shoes on, which is, I'm sure, as she would want to go, working for peace. Like I say, I'm only guessing that when I met her, she was in her late 50s, so that probably put her in her late 60s sometime. Yeah. So this is her writing. I was working in the 5 and 10 cent store between my junior and senior year in high school. I just loved the work, especially fixing up counters so they would look pretty. They even let me fix up the windows because I like to do that. Well, you know, I was cheaper than a window decorator. I had two registers at my corner. One day I didn't have the proper change in one register, so naturally I went over to the other and rang no sale and took out the change. Then I discovered I had committed a cardinal sin. I heard them whispering, "She rang no sale." The male floor walker came over and said, "Come with me." He put me at a counter in a corner. He put me in a counter over in a corner needing fixing up. He left me there and then came back and said, "Why did you do that?" I replied, "I still don't know what I did. I just took change out of the register. I didn't steal any money." He said, "You're instructed never to ring no sale." I answered, "I wasn't instructed at all." Then he went to the female floor walker who was supposed to have instructed me. I was reinstated, but because of the incident, she then hated me. I knew that something needed to be done about it. Then I passed her desk and noticed a few faded flowers there. The next morning, I brought her in a beautiful bouquet of flowers from my garden. I said, "I noticed those faded flowers. I know you love flowers, and here are some for my garden." She couldn't resist them. At the end of the week, we walked out of there arm in arm. I feel sure I was being prepared for the pilgrimage when I read the golden rule in history: do unto others what you would have others do unto you, expressed in a lot of different ways and pointing out that every culture had one. It got an inner confirmation for me. It affected my entire life. In fact, there were certain offshoots of the golden rule which carried over even into the pilgrimage. When I was in high school, I had a little saying, "If you want to make friends, you must be friendly." If you analyze it, it's an offshoot of the golden rule. It is the recognition that people react according to the influence brought to bear upon them. I have it in my life today with my little saying, "If you want to make peace, you must be peaceful." It's amazing how many people that I meet who are interested in world peace, but they themselves are extremely angry individuals and have no peace inside of them at all. I'd like to read from Master's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, beginning with verse 54. Arjuna said, "O Krishna, what are the characteristics of the sage who possesses ever-calm wisdom and who is steeped in samadhi, in ecstasy? How does this man of steady wisdom speak and sit and walk?" Krishna replied, "O Arjuna, when a man completely relinquishes all desires of the mind and is entirely contented in the self, by the self, then he is considered to be one settled in wisdom. He whose consciousness is not shaken by anxiety under afflictions, nor by attachment to happiness under favorable circumstances. He who is free from worldly loves, fears, and angers. He is called a Muni, a person of realization, and he is of steady discrimination. He who is everywhere unattached, neither joyously excited by encountering good nor disturbed by evil, has an established wisdom." And Master's commentary: "He who can glide like a swan in the waters of life without wetting the feathers of his faculties in a deep sea of attachment, who is not excited while riding on the sunny crests of the waves, nor afraid while floating down the dark currents of evil happenings, has a wisdom ever poised, unwavering." I remember once when I was working in an agency that was going through a lot of change. Some people were being let go of. There was reorganization. There's a lot of unsettlement. There were people who were feeling a lot of fear and anxiety, and people under the best of circumstances oftentimes don't care for change. When I was walking in the morning into that agency, it was as if I could feel the vibration of fear and anxiety permeating through that building and coming out through the doors as I walked into them. And I had a vision that came to my mind at that time, where I saw in my mind's eye a swan swimming upon the water of a lake. Down in the muck and the mire of the water were the paddles of the swan's feet, pushing it along, but up above on the water's surface, this wonderful, brilliant white swan was serenely moving through the water. And instantly I felt a kind of calm come over me, and I felt unaffected by the vibrations that I was walking into of fear and anxiety. Paramahansa, which is the title that was given to Yogananda by Swami Sri Yukteswarji, means supreme swan, and it means one who has attained that kind of equanimity of mind. Now, to be unattached means that we are not overly excited by the things of this world, either in a positive or a negative sense. And you can think to yourself, well, I like to be excited. I like to think about things that I might be able to have, or I like to be able to think about the things that I do have, and I feel pleasure from them. But if the cost of having this excitement over these things is to become imprisoned in yourself, then it's a very high cost indeed. The presumption is that if I am unattached, I will cease to experience anything in a positive sense. I will just be neutral. I'll be a cold fish. But when we look at the lives of great masters, such as Mother Hamilton of Master, of Papa, these people are not non-entities. They're not people who don't experience life. They're not people who don't enjoy life. And yet, inwardly, deep within their hearts and their souls, they feel an unflappable calm that is deep within them. And it is here that the real yogi, or one who is established in the divine consciousness, really shines. Because there, nothing of the waves of likes and dislikes touches that place of calm and equanimity deep within their heart. They feel there a constant and abiding sense of their true self. Now, the true self, you can say with a capital S, it isn't encapsulated by this little self, the ego self. The ego self is identified with this body. The ego self is the one who says, I like this, I dislike that. And truly, as individuals, we have our preferences. We have our likes and our dislikes. So you do not become a non-entity. But for the ordinary individual, when they have their likes and dislikes and they are disappointed in life, they don't have things go their way, they're disturbed right down to the core of their being. They lose it, as the saying goes. They become either over-infatuated with a certain thing, or they become repulsed by another thing. And it is such a powerful response to this world that they lose any sense of their permanent and abiding self. This is the great penalty that is paid by those who live in attachment in this world. To live with detachment in the world means that we have taken up a superior joy, a superior life to that which we enjoy in this world. And when you experience things deep within your soul, you experience the bliss, the light, the love, the joy, the everythingness of God, then you enter into that supreme life. Papa Ram Dass describes how when he walked all over India, how he is chanting the name Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. That is, victory to God, victory to the light. And he chanted this in a little song that he made up. And as he did it, he felt an interior bliss that lifted him up. And he would walk upon rocks. He would walk upon areas that had thorns, and the thorns would deeply embedded themselves into his feet. And he was uncaring for any of this because he was so caught up in this feeling of bliss that was lifting him up past concerns of the body. That is the way that we can be. We can have this kind of bliss. And yet he related to everybody that he met. And he felt that everybody that he met was an incarnation of the divine consciousness and had come to him for a particular purpose. He very humorously describes how in different circumstances he would feel that whatever circumstance he was in, this was God who had come to him. He described it how one time he was in a small town and all the people there came to him as a saint and were chanting God's name. They put him up on a dais. They worshipped him with sandal paste and with flowers and with all different kinds of foods that they gave to him, which he then distributed out to all the people. And everyone there felt greatly blessed, and he is treated as a god. And then he got onto a train. Well, when he rode trains, he didn't pay anything since he didn't have any money with him. So he got onto this train, and more people came onto the train as it stopped at each station. And he just curled himself up into a little ball. And suddenly, this very, very crowded train, he was a small man, but he's curled up in a tiny little ball in the corner. People were kicking him, and they didn't quite realize. Maybe they thought he was just some baggage or something, and they would kick him and try to move him around if he is in their way. And he started laughing to himself, and he said, "Oh, Ram, oh, God, you are so delightful. At one point, you put Ram Dass up on a dais, and you worship him as if he is God. And then you put him down in a little ball on the floor of the train, and you're kicking him and you're pushing him around as if he's nothing at all. And you are teaching Ram Dass that no matter what happens to him, it is all the same life. It is all the same joy. You are the only thing that is ever present and ever new." And he, in this way, made himself remind himself that everything was God. Everything was God. There was another time when he was on a train without a ticket, and he and some other sadhus were thrown off. The sadhus generally rode without buying tickets because they didn't carry money. And so the train man there at the station lined them all up, and he made them get up, and he made them get over and sit down there. And then he'd come out after a minute, and he said, "Not over there, over here." And he'd make them all get up and move over as one and sit down in another place. And he kept coming out, and he did this over and over and over again. And one of the other sadhus started to grumble, and he says, "What is this? This man seems to just want us to make us move from place to place." And Papa was laughing inside, and he said, "Nothing of the sort. God saw that we had been riding on the train for such a long time, and he thought we needed the exercise of getting up and moving over and sitting down and then getting up and moving over and sitting down. He didn't want us sitting in one place all this time." And so this is the way that his mind worked. And it's wonderful. It's wonderful. When you can see the people in your life as manifestations of the divine consciousness, that they aren't there by accident. They're there sometimes to test us, to see whether we can see that the divine is hiding behind the mask that we see. Sometimes they come to serve us. Sometimes they come to love us. Sometimes they come as our crucifixion and our opposing force. But however that one comes, it is by explicit design. We don't think that we are in the wrong place at the wrong time. We don't think that life has taken a malevolent turn upon us, but that life is benevolent always. It is always giving to us. It is always striving to bring out the best inside of us. But what lesson do we learn from life? Do we learn this kind of lesson from life, or do we begin to think that life is bitterness, life is difficulty and hard, that things should be easier, and when something comes along as a challenge, something for us to overcome, we meet it with resentment, with bitterness. We don't see the joy in it. We don't see the divine consciousness in it. Sometimes when people come to you, they are so outrageous that you can think there is nothing but God here. No human being would ever act like that. One time, a man came up to me, and seemingly out of the blue, and he just started yelling at me with such vehemence, and just inches away from me. And he was talking at the top of his lungs. And it hit me as so humorous, no person in the world would do something like this in an ordinary state of mind. This must be God. And so I just looked at him. I was just present with him as he was yelling at me. And suddenly he just calmed down as if he was a storm that was just going for everything it was worth, and it ran completely out of steam. And then he acted completely normal, like he didn't do anything at all after that. And if I had reacted to him, perhaps we would have had a grand fight right there. But as a result, the storm seemed to blow itself out. And he was all done. And whatever it is that he needed to get off his chest hadn't anything to do with me, but I was glad to let him do it. And now he could go on his way, and perhaps he would experience a little bit more peace. You see, in order for there to be peace in this world, we must have peace inside of ourselves. If we start giving a black eye for every black eye that is given, and we start breaking a bone for every broken bone that's done, pretty soon, all of this world will have black eyes and broken bones. But instead, if we can see with patience, well, there must be something in this for me. Perhaps I can serve this person in some way. As Peace Pilgrim, earlier in her previous life, saw with this woman, that this woman was very angry with her. And she thought, what can I do about this? How can I set the situation right? And in Swami Satchidananda's prayer, he says, it is not ours to find fault, but how shall we set the situation right? When you stay focused on that, and you do it with a calm mind, you will be led. You will be led through your reason, and you will be led through your intuition. When I was at work one time, there was somebody who was having a very difficult time of it. And they were feeling very angry that day. And we sat down, and they were able to just talk for a little bit. And I didn't say anything really too much in response, but I felt great peace in my heart. And I just sat with her for a while like that. And after a while, she seemed to be done. And she got up and she said she felt ever so much better. And she went off on her way. The kinds of things that are needing fixing in this life oftentimes aren't to do with the reasoning mind. They are deep within the heart. And within your own heart, if you can feel the flow of love, now all of us have access to this, but few of us are trained into how to allow this love to flow. In your mind's eye, if you see a flow of life and light and love coming from behind you and into your heart, and from your heart, that soothing peace and love moves right on through you and then out to the world from you. And if you are disturbed by anybody in particular, just have them come to your mind right now and see that movement of life, of love, of peace, moving from your heart out to that individual. See them bathed in that light. See them saturated in that peace and in that love. And see them having access to that through their own heart, that they have their own source flowing to their heart. And see them open to that. and see their heart healed by that. Now, the thing is that it's a thrice blessing. It blesses you, number one, when you begin to think about that person in that way. You feel more calm. You feel more at peace. Then the other individual, even if they're at a long distance from you, they start to feel it too, because that's something that's coming their way. And then all the people who are around you will also feel it, because it has a general emanation from you. And as you cultivate a mind of peace, a soul of peace, then you will manifest that wherever you are. And you will have people come up to you and they'll just say, "You just appear so calm," or "I just feel such a great sense of peace when I'm with you." And you will start a conflagration of peace that will just begin to spread out from you and go out from person to person. And wouldn't it be tremendous if this golden rule around doing unto others as you would be done unto, if everybody acted upon that, what this world would be like? What a transformation this world would go through. And how this world would be brought into a new age, into an age of peace. And how desperately this world needs that at this time. This is a tremendous thing, and it starts with each one of us as individuals. Everybody can begin right today. You can send out this prayer of peace to individuals or to the world as a whole, because the same principle applies in either sense. And most of all, that you feel that peace within you. You become an ambassador of peace. And then you look at situations as, how do we set the situation right? Mine is not to find fault and blame, but how do I set the situation right? And then you go about doing it. And this is the way that we change the world. And the world can be changed in this way. Now, it's not that everybody needs to start acting like this. There are sociological principles that talked about when a small percentage of people with great determination begin to change themselves, they change the entire society. And so it can be a quiet revolution that goes out. A revolution of peace, a revolution of divine consciousness that begins to saturate all people alike. And we can see the change in this world. There is but one religion, and it is a religion of love. It is a religion of peace. It is a religion of but one God. And it is the same God who resides deep within the hearts and souls of everybody this world over. And now, as you look out, you see yourself within every person that you meet. And you cannot have a stranger wherever you go, because all are part and parcel of your own divine being that you have realized through your uplifted consciousness. So let us make this world a peace. Let us have the signs of somebody who lives in this uplifted consciousness. And not be reactive to this world, but be a conduit of divine consciousness and peace. I would like to see now if there are any questions or about anything that I've spoken about or about your own spiritual path right now. Perhaps you're all floating on a sea of peace.
David, you know, you think of peace as a, you know, a state to attain to. But isn't there times in your connection with God when that's not how God manifests himself? I mean, maybe there's tremendous action to be taken or something to be done.
The difference is that when an ordinary person acts, they identify themselves with the action. I'm doing this, and you feel yourself all part of that action. As the state of realization grows inside of you, there's a part of you that doesn't engage in that action. It is what Krishna calls actionless action. And it is a place of stillness right inside of your own heart, right inside of your own soul. It's unaffected whether you're in action or not action. And it's from that place that you act. For instance, if somebody does something that makes us tremendously angry, and we feel that flush of anger come up through us and we want to speak out, maybe we want to strike out, we're just really caught up in that emotion. And when you are not having that state of equanimity inside, that rules you. And you may say things that you later regret. You may say things that aren't true or certainly out of perspective. And later on you would say, oh, I overstated that. That was too much. Or I did actions that were too much. I hit my fist on that door and broke that door, and that was not the right thing to do. When you have that state of inner stillness and calmness, there's a place of reflection that happens before the angry energy emanates out. And so you're judging, you're observing what is coming up out of you. And since that place is aligned with truth, you would not speak an untruth. And you would not do an action that was too far over the line, that later on you would judge, that was too much, that was over the line there, that my anger got the better of me there. So in that state of equanimity, you're in total command. And that's what self-mastery is having that kind of total command. So from that standpoint, even in the state of great activity, maybe even in righteous anger, you would have that inner state of stillness, always intact.
So that core of peace is always with you.
Always with you.
Oh, boy. No wonder they call it heaven.
Yes, yeah. And we feel, well, maybe I will miss out, you know, will I be alive, you know, will I have passion for things? All of those things are there, but nothing overwhelms that sense of equanimity deep within you. And as a result, your actions are aligned and attuned with divine consciousness. Your intuition, you have open access to it. Your reasoning mind operates better because it has a calm flow to it.
So I notice that sometimes people that give seminars or try and elevate people's state of living, they talk about, well, you're going to be able to access all this passion and you know, this what you're really excited about and so forth. So
right.
They're trying to get people elevated out of a very mundane state.
People who feel stuck inside. And that can be a positive step to take, that you're activating something that before had become stuck.
But this state you're talking about is above that.
Yes.
Because you're not being ruled by these passions or these...
Right. Say that you have a strong desire for something. Well, that strong desire can be unsettling to you. It can throw you out of balance. It can make you not see the good that's in your life right now because you don't have that certain thing. Or people who attract a certain amount of affluence to themselves and they're afraid of what will be taken from them once they have it. So there's no rest or peacefulness that comes with that either. It's you always feel like you're on a razor's edge with it all. And there's no real peace with it. So to achieve that is to find where real happiness and lasting happiness happens. Now, it's considered in general that a rajasic state or an activated state is preferable to a tamasic state or a stuck, like glue kind of state. So people who are involved in trying to actualize people's dreams and get them activated, that's a very positive thing for people who are tamasic.
You know, I've heard you mention something before that I'm a little confused about, and maybe you can clarify. You've talked about, I think, being in a tamasic or a rajasic or a sattvic state and being with God.
Yeah.
In any three of those states. Whereas always before I thought, oh no, it's just sattvic. That's the only one you can be, you know, and be with God.
Sattvic is that very cool, calm kind of flow of being, and that's a sattvic state. But a rajasic, for instance, a righteous indignation or anger can come up. Let's say there's a serious injustice going on, and you think something needs to be done here, and you feel that powerfully inside of you. And so you act with that. That energy that you're feeling at that time is not necessarily sattvic. It's rajasic. But the inner stillness and calm inside your heart goes beyond all three of the gunas, or the tamasic, the rajasic, or the sattvic.
So this is interesting. So it's possible to be connected with God, have that connection, and be in any of those states.
Right. Right. Yet there's a state that goes beyond all three of those. And that is that inner equanimity, or that stillness inside.
So a God-realized individual could be exhibiting any one of these.
Anyone, yeah.
And from outward appearances, you go, oh, well, goodness, that person is sad. Or they seem to be
Right. Well, say for instance that Anande Moy Ma, there's a wonderful story about Ma, where a woman came who had been in grief for, I think it was 4 or 5 years, for the death of a child that she had. A terrible thing for anyone, for any mother, of course. But she wasn't getting past it. She wasn't slowly recovering from that kind of grief. She was crying every single day and in really bad shape. So a group of people brought this woman to Ma, hoping that there could be some healing for her. The woman came and sat down and looked very glum in front of Ma, and suddenly Anande Moy Ma started to cry. And cry, and really cry. I mean, just uncontrollable tears and heaving coming down. And the other woman, eventually, she looked up and she saw Ma just in this complete state of grief. And you know what the woman did? She got up, she came up, she put her arm around Ma, she started comforting Ma in her grief. And that drew the woman out. And suddenly she started letting go of her own grief, because she was showing compassion to somebody else who was grieving more than she. And so there's a wonderful story. Another wonderful story is Mother Krishnabai. And after Papa's passing, she was uncontrollably grieving. And the devotees got worried about her. I mean, this is day after day after day, and some weeks went by. And they said, Mataji, you're God-realized, but you're grieving like this. She says, yes. She says, I'm grieving for all of you. You had Papa here. You had an incarnation right here with you. And which of you took advantage of him? No, none of you did. And now the time has passed, and I'm grieving for all of your souls. So the grief was there, a tamasic state. But somebody, in both cases, somebody who is in a completely realized state. But inwardly, they would be unaffected. They would not be bound by these kinds of emotions, because they're not coming from those places.
Thank you for defining that. That clarifies it really well.
Yeah.
Appreciate
that. And another story is Papa. And there's a sadhu who came to the ashram, and he was not behaving correctly. He was ordering people around, and then he was approaching some of the women who were there and was not behaving correctly at all. Finally, one too many story came to Papa, said, that's it. He went to the fellow's room. He knocked on the door. He wouldn't answer. Knocked on the door some more. Eventually he came out. He had been shaving his head. And Papa says, "You have to leave the ashram. You're not behaving correctly." "No, no, no, no. This is my ashram. I won't leave." Papa said, "No, you leave now." The man said, "No, I won't leave. I refuse." Papa started pushing the man. He even kicked him and pushed him and displayed a lot of anger and said, "Get out now." Very angry. And so some of the people actually left Papa and left the ashram at that time because they didn't think that he had attained the state that he said he did because he had displayed anger like that. But that was exactly what was needed for that individual at the time. So any state, and this is what can be misused at times because there are people who say that they have reached that state of spiritual illumination and then go off to do every licentious thing that you can think of, and they make the excuse, "Well, I'm in a realized state. I can do all of this, but you can't." There was a lama that was parading around at one time and was an alcoholic. He got married to a young girl who he barely knew, and people kept on coming to him, you know, as if he was in a state of realization, and died an early death because he had cirrhosis of the liver.
I hear stories like that, and these people must have some personal power.
They have a magnetism to them, of course. But it's much different to have a personal magnetism and to have a state of realization. Some people have state of realization and little or no magnetism at all.
Yeah.
So it's not popularity contest. That's not where it's at. But it's the ability to help individuals who are striving for divine consciousness to be lifted up into that state of higher consciousness. That is what a person of realization may do, that others cannot do in the same kind of way.
You know, it almost seems like, you know, this whole path is kind of fun because it's sort of like a big experiment. But it seems like it gets down to either, you know, your talk is on peace. And it seems like during the day I notice either your mind is on God, and, you know, you have that peace inside, or your mind isn't on God, and you're scattered out in the world. And in my current state of consciousness, that seems to be how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Either the mind is on God, and of course all kinds of things are going on around you, but your mind's on God, and you have some toehold in that peaceful state.
Yeah.
Or you're not.
Well, that's as you rise up in consciousness, that demarcation becomes more and more pronounced.
Well, it seems like it's just simply night and day.
Yeah.
It's either you're in that there or you're not. And
yes.
It becomes really, I mean, you start getting, so you're going, "Well, I really like this one up here."
Of course.
And I really, so, you know, this one over here just doesn't work too well.
Of course,
I mean,
yeah.
You say that, it's like a form of attachment even, and it's another step to go through because it's like you're not supposed to be attached to that either.
Well, in the beginning, of course, we want to get attached to that higher state, to that sattvic state, to that peaceful state. And that's a positive thing at one time because we want to experience more of that. We want to feel the draw and attraction to that in contrast to a state of separation and ignorance. Ultimately, we have to give up even our attachment to that. I remember having certain experiences come along in the ascension up towards divine consciousness. And there would be states of consciousness and states of mind, I think, I never want this to end. I want it to be just like this. Well, that's not possible because divine consciousness is ever expressing itself new, and you can't hang on to one thing. You can't hang on to one experience and say this is it. So divine consciousness is ever new, and for it to be ever new, it has to be unfolding in new ways, and you have to allow it to do that. So at that point, you renounce or you let go even of any sense of attachment to any particular state of being, including peace, including love, including joy. You can't hang on to any of it.
Well, can't you just at least just hang on to God? can't you just hang on to God?
Ultimately, no, because any conception of God is done with the mind.
But how do you keep your consciousness on God all the time if you can't hang on to it?
The difference now is that God is spontaneously flowing through you. So the idea of keeping your mind on God is something that is concerning the mind, and you've gone beyond the mind.
It also, I guess, implies separation.
It does. It does. There's I and thou. There's separation there. When you feel this divine consciousness flowing through you spontaneously, and you surrender to that, wherever it takes you, whatever it does, it's fine with you, then you've really surrendered at that time. And if it takes you into, for instance, there are times when things happen in this world to individuals or to larger parts of the world, and I feel a tremendous sense of grief over it because of the pain and the suffering that's been gone through at that time. I feel no resistance to that kind of love that's flowing. It's not mine. It's not something that I'm doing. It's something that's happening spontaneously. But it's fine with me. And when I don't fight it or resist it, there is also a tremendous sense of peace and spiritual vibrancy that comes along with that kind of pain. And yet it is pain. So you don't resist anything. You accept what comes, and it is perfect just as it is. So you can't get... Mother described it as the difference between saint consciousness and cosmic consciousness. In saint consciousness, you're still striving for the higher, and so you're adopting what is good, what is right, what is of the light.
Yeah.
But it's you striving. It's you, and that's the proper thing at one point. But where you get to a certain height of consciousness and you let go of even what is good, what is bad, because you feel actively that divine consciousness operating through you constantly. And sometimes you do things that makes you shake your head a little bit. You go, well, that's interesting. And yet you feel the divine vibration and consciousness, its imprint, very definitely on that. When you reflect on it, you don't feel that it's been outside of divine consciousness. It's a part of it. This is very refined consciousness, so it's not something that can be just thought about in ordinary ways. But when you have that experience, you recognize it, and you recognize the difference. It takes you beyond good and evil. So that Papa might push you, you know, as a saint, he wouldn't get angry at this fellow. He wouldn't push him off of the ashram premises. But as a fully realized, he could do that if that was how God was moving through him.
So in one very real sense, you don't really go through your day. Obviously, you know, you have plans. You decide, you know, to come down here, take a trip or whatever. But you're not going through your day deciding how you're going to handle things or what you're necessarily going to do. God takes you by the hand. And
you can have plans, but life is a moment-to-moment unfoldment. And you have complete freedom in that.
So, for example, and you know, when Papa was sitting in his chair and they came to him and they said, oh, this Swami, he's gone and done this and that again or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So he decides, well, something must be done. But when he's going over there, he isn't necessarily going, I'm going to kick him and I'm going to hit him or any of that. It's not necessarily premeditated. It's just God flowing through him, and that's the appropriate thing at that moment.
Right.
Is that how it's working?
Well, you'll have to ask Papa for that.
Well, sure. But I'm just trying to, in that state of consciousness, how do those things sort of unfold?
Well, as I say, it's not necessary that you not make plans. You can still make plans. But it really is, what dictates it is how divine consciousness flows through you from moment to moment.
So those plans will sometimes change.
Sometimes. The best laid plans.
Of course, well, and then in human consciousness, of course, they change too.
Mm-hmm. And embroidered through all of that is that vibration of peace, the peace that surpasses all understanding. And when you have that, then you feel like you have everything. And yet desire nature can draw you up and you have a certain, okay, this is to happen next, or this is to be created, or... But the relationship to it now is different. You feel like this is a creative desire that's springing forward through you rather than from you. And that it's, if it's to be brought into creation, it's something that will be orchestrated through divine consciousness. It doesn't make you a non-entity.
Right.
So desire nature from that standpoint, you can say, is there. And yet it is desireless desire. Because inside of you, you don't feel the same attachment to it that you did before.
So would it be true to say then those desires are coming from God?
Yes.
Okay.
The ultimate architect of the universe.
He's expressing himself.
Yes. And it's delightful. It's joyful. It's a joyful expression. All this creation is said to be Ananda. It's joyful expression. It's an explosion of joy. And how far we've come from that notion that this creation is an explosion of joy. Instead, it seems to be heartache, and it seems to be hard and difficult and disappointing and so much grief. But that's not how it was intended. That's not how it was created. That's the filter of the mind that we see it through.
That's some good news, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That it's made up of joy itself. And we live in an ocean of joy.
You know, when you describe these things, I can't help but simultaneously have two thoughts. One is that what a wonderful world it could be. And the second thought is, it seems like it's a long ways away. And I know you say it's right there, you know, it's right close to you and with you, but you think of maybe your current state of consciousness, then you think of this consciousness as described, and you think, oh my goodness, what a long distance, you know, I have.
Yeah. Kabir says, it makes me laugh to think of an ocean, of a fish swimming in the ocean, saying that it's thirsty. Or... The atoms of space around us are filled with vibrancy of joy. We live in an ocean of joy, of cosmic vibration. But it's just like a radio that's been tuned off of a channel, and now it's just getting static and unlovely kinds of sounds that are coming through it. And you just think, this radio is worthless, it's awful. But you just turn the dial rightly and you get it onto channel, and suddenly the most beautiful music comes from it. And our minds have been those dials, and we've tuned ourselves incorrectly, and that's why we don't experience these kinds of things that I'm talking about. There's nothing unique about Papa or Master or Mother in the sense that they attained something that nobody else can attain. They're really harbingers calling all of us, you too can have what I have. But who believes them? Really?
It sounds like you have to stop and just allow it to happen.
There's two aspects. When somebody first hears about it and they don't have any sense of it all, you have to use the mind because that's what we have. But when you feel that divine presence, and it can come in any notion at all, just a sense of peace, a sense of joy, a sense of upliftment, a sense of light, and we feel that begin to flow through us, then we step aside. The humorous kind of analogy that God gave me is when I was young, did a little siphoning of gas, always from my own gas tank, you have to understand. And so, you know, the trick was you would suck on this tube right up until the point that the gas got to your mouth, and then you got your mouth out of the way and gravity took over and it would drain from one tank into the other. And of course, if you kept on sucking, you got a mouthful of gas, which was a pretty unpleasant experience. And our spiritual sadhana is like that we're sucking on this tube to get this divine nectar, to get this divine flow to move. And once it gets to us, we have to stop sucking, and then a spiritual force takes over and the flow happens naturally. Now, if we continue to suck out of the tube, we would be actually inhibiting the flow rather than helping it. Yet we needed it to get it to that point. And then we get out of the way and we become a witness, we become an observer to what's going on through us. So if you tell somebody who has no sense of the divine presence, well, you just stop the mind, you just get out of the way. Get out of the way of what? They have no sense of it. But when that moment happens and you feel that flow, getting out of the way makes total sense, because you realize you trying to do too much inhibits that flow. Getting quiet and having that equal mind inside, that increases the flow. Oh, all of a sudden, all of that makes sense now. And now the practice is stepping out of the way, stepping aside, and letting that flow, and it increases, and it grows. But the mind is so subtle, it wants to insert itself in there, it wants to make itself a part of, and as soon as it does, it stops the flow. I remember times of being uplifted in divine consciousness and just thinking, I never want this to stop. And then I would start to descend from this height of consciousness, and I would just, no, you know, I just, no, don't. And what I realized later on was it was my own sense of attachment that acted like lead weights that began to bring the balloon down. They were subtle, so I didn't recognize my own attachment, but it could be the attachment of, I don't want this to stop. Now, who's the I? I'm in there, I'm interfering with that flow now. And so the flow stops. And it's maddening. But of course, then we go back and to our practice and get that flow going again, and we learn. It's the most fascinating, most challenging kind of path that you can imagine. But it's wonderful. Wonderful. Great results.
Don't you feel like this is kind of like the best
Oh, you know, gosh, if it could somehow be conveyed, what is possible, that you know that people would just take a giant sigh of relief and go, it's true, what I felt inside of me. I didn't have a name for it, I didn't know what to call it, but it's true. And I could have that, I could experience that. But this veil of Maya comes over. This veil of ignorance comes over. And all the great saints talk about its inscrutable nature. Why does that do that? And even after you've been uplifted in divine consciousness, it comes over you as if it never existed, as if divine consciousness never existed. And when you're up in that uplifted state, you can't ever believe you would never have that again. It just, this has got to be true for all time. And then suddenly, it's gone as if it never existed. It's the most amazing thing. It's a disappearing act. So Papa said it's only until grace comes in and lifts you up. And until then, what good does it do? I have a playful puppy.
She lost something at the couch. But you can't make grace come.
You cannot. What you can do is invite it in. Open yourself to it. And when you do, then you can just become receptive, and yearn for it with everything inside of you. Nothing in life makes sense unless I have this grace, unless I have this feeling of upliftment. Come into my heart, come into my soul, lift me up. Reveal thyself to me. And you just, with all of your heart, you yearn for that. And when you do, there's a kind of magnetism with that that God can't resist. It's said that God is all powerful, but when that the devotee makes themselves completely surrender to God, God can't ignore them. He's completely helpless to the devotee then. He has to rush to him. But when we feel the very definite difference between our effort and when that spiritual power and intelligence comes in and begins to operate in us, there's such a marked contrast between them. There's no mistaking the two. That's good news. It's good news. And we very definitely see, this is my intelligence, this is my will, and this is divine intelligence, this is divine will. And they stand in very marked contrast to each other. Before that, we're striving to live a spiritual life, but we haven't yet really been initiated into that inner life yet. And some people spend years and years and years trying to cultivate that and don't have it. When Papa Ramdas took to the sannyas life, different sadhus would see him, and they'd see the difference in him. They'd see him lit up with this divine effulgence and this joy. And they say, how long have you been practicing? How long have you been doing this? And Papa would say, Ramdas has been doing this less than a year. What? I've been wandering penniless and in these ochre robes for 20, 30 years? I don't have what you have. Why? I've been sincere. I've been trying to do everything I can to make this awaken. Papa would say, I don't know. I can't tell. He says it's like a little child that you have in the middle of a group of people, and the child has a toy, and everybody's saying, bring the toy to me. And then suddenly the child sees somebody out on the street and runs out and hands it to them. How do you explain it? He was just trying to describe his own feeling of gratitude and that he was nobody special. And yet, this grace had come on him and he was swimming in the ocean of Ananda, of bliss. So when you awaken to it, you cannot not see it. When you have not awakened to it, it sounds nice, it sounds okay, but it just doesn't call to you in the same way. But it's the most wonderful thing you can possibly imagine. Everything that your heart yearns for is satisfied in that divine consciousness.